Our dialogue today deals with halacha and community, which the Rav gave in essence at the Boston conference, and all of you received an abstract from a committee that went over it. There's a special committee, they're not all here, one is in the audience today. Rivka Danzig is not here because she has certain schoolwork she couldn't be relieved from. But Dr. Sal Green and Dr. Penny Connor, Lester Kaufman, have worked out a number of questions. And Sal will be the one who will be leading the dialogue team with two purposes in mind. The first purpose is to bring out some kind of a thrust so that we get a sequential type of approach. And the other is to try to keep fleshing these things out, in plain language, to extract from the Rav as much pearls of wisdom as we can in this most important subject for us. And then at the end, we'll ask Sal to try to summarize so we know where we can pick up from there. But before we even do that, I have a question, which the youth hero was a little hesitant to put down in the questions. And my question is as follows. Because the Rav made a point about Knesset Yisrael being an existential community. Now let us be honest and candid with ourselves. We live in an open American society and we are exposed to atheistic existentialism, which all of us, I would assume, are against. Put the word communist if you want. Christian existentialism, which is a lot more prevalent in this country. And, of course, what we want to get into the heart and soul of what is Jewish existentialism. So that we have clarity of thought and proceedings, I'll ask the Rav, before we even ply him with the other questions, could he compare these three types of existentialism or give us some kind of working definition so we go b'derech hashara? Thank you. Do you need us to use the mic in the back? Don't need it.
I was
more comfortable
after that. Yes, what's the question again? I mean, I got it in writing.
I got it in writing.
In what way does the existential community give the individual Jew life meaning, and the individual Jew gives Knesset Yisrael meaning? This is the question?
Well, that's the corollary question. Before that is, could you define, comparatively, what is atheistic as existentialism
as a matter of fact, I did not use the term existential community. So I'll read from the manuscript.
Okay.
What I wanted to say, what I believe I tried to explain...
Put the mic. Is this mic working?
This is for the
patient. Maybe
people can move down
here
from the back.
You don't
deny. No, it looks like they don't have a mic.
Would some of you in the back like to move up front? Because we don't have a mic at the moment.
Could you put this on a second in the van?
I can use it as a mic. What? So we have a mic.
This is a mic.
This can be used as a mic. Will you fix it?
Yeah, right. So we have to unhook this one. Right there.
Do you have it set up?
No,
I'm set on,
Chef. How do you unhook it?
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought that he wanted to help the group understand the idea of existentialism.
Yes, but what...
It's working?
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir. This mic is working.
The bell's working.
Do I have to hold it?
No, thanks, sir. I'm not sure. No, it's working.
To explain in my lecture in Boston is the following, and I read from the paper. The community in Judaism is not a functional, utilitarian, but an ontological one. Ontological one means a real one. I might have used, I mean, the word existential, but not an existential community, but I meant it more in the sense, in the literal sense of the word. The community exists as such. The community is not just an assembly of people who coordinated their efforts and distributed assignments, but in an entity per se, an individuality, I might say a living whole. The Jewish community, the Knesset Israel, is not a conglomerate, but an independent unity. The Knesset Israel is a macro-anthropos. It's like an individual, like a man, but a big one. A being, autonomous and alive. Let us take an example. We lay claim to Eretz Israel. God promised us that the land be under our control. To whom did he pledge the land? He, capital, of course. Not to an individual, neither to 15 million people. He promised it to the Knesset Israel, to the community as an independent unity, as a separate juridic, metaphysical person. He did not promise the land to me, he didn't promise to you, he didn't promise to them. Nor did he promise the land to all of us together. To a partnership. He promised the land to an individuality, to the Knesset Israel, as a community persona, hyphenated, as a community persona. Judaic sociological ideas turn into mystical experiences, into realities. The Knesset Israel is a living, loving, and suffering mother. Now let me ask you, what has it got to do with Christian existentialism? Or with Catholic, or with Sartre's atheist existentialism? And I arrived at the conclusion purely halachically. It was not my... I arrived at the conclusion not while I was in a philosophical mood, but while studying the halacha. Because we have... In the halacha we have two concepts, shutfim, partnership, which is almost unlimited. You can have a billion people in it, but the billion people don't form a personalistic unity or entity, but it is a conglomerate, it's an assembly of many. Each one has a particle, for instance. If Eretz Yisrael had been promised, I mean, to us, as partners, to the people as the partnership, then each one of us would have had a little part in our story. I would say a particle in our story. But it isn't so. The land was not given to us, to many individuals. Regardless of the numbers, it was given to a certain persona, to a certain personality, to a unity, to a certain entity, which, as I said, a macroanthropos. And this entity is both a juridic as well as a metaphysical personality. And that's how I arrived at the concept of community, the organic, not even the word organic doesn't cover it. The community is a metaphysical entity or an ontological entity.
The function of a Jew is to be holy. The function of
just a moment. I'm not ready. Yes.
Yeah? The rabbi was prepared to give a paper.
No, I wasn't going to do that.
Okay.
I received about a list of questions. I answered, I believe, 5 or 4, with the exception of 2 I did not answer, for simple reason I didn't understand. So if you want me, I'll answer those questions which were submitted to me.
Okay.
I'll say, frankly, I didn't know what my role is supposed to be. Now, question number 1. I believe questions are signed by the president. What are the consequences of the relationship? In what way does the existential community give the individual Jew life meaning? And vice versa, the individual Jew gives a life meaning to the Knesset Yisrael. This question I understand very well. Matter of fact, I developed the idea of complementarity there, and also the idea that man was created at the same time as a community or collectivity related being, as well as a lonely individual. The question, well, who came first, what happened, with the question which bothered the mind of the philosopher of Age of Reason and the conclusion from Contrat Social at which they arrived is completely non-existent as far as Judaism is concerned, because in Judaism they both came into being almost simultaneously. First man as a lonely being, and then man vis-a-vis his partner, Adam vis-a-vis Eve. And actually, man is at the same time both a community-related being and a lonely being. So I understood your question is, in practical terms, how does it express? Is it correct?
Right.
That's what I understood. Now let us see. Perhaps what I'm going to say will sound funny to you, but the consequences, of this philosophy means that man is, with regard to community, is a dialectical being. I mean, he belongs to community, he doesn't belong. He may retreat from the community and he may search forward towards the community. But of course it's a dialectical approach to man. There is an inner contradiction in man. The consequences are enormous in practical terms. The biblical community reveals to the individual Jew, I'll use now the term existential, but it's not meant in the technical meaning of the movement. It reveals to the individual Jew new existential dimensions, new ontological dimensions, a new metaphysique. It provides the individual Jew, and what I'm going to say here is purely personal. It's hard for me to explain, but it's a part of my experience, or rather ontological experience. Provides the individual Jew with a deep, deep-reaching root. He suddenly, when he experiences himself as a part of the ontological community, he ceases to be a wanderer, a novenard, but basically to be a wanderer, even though the curse was imposed upon Cain, but actually man, but it is applicable to everyone, to every man. We are wanderers, novenards. I mean the sense that we are ruthless. We are ruthless. For instance, the fear of death, which corrupts our life experience, is alleviated or allayed through the act of joining the existential community. The individual suddenly discovers that he is an integral part of something, and I'm speaking in religious terms, of a community which is not temporal, but I would say is everlasting, eternal community. He suddenly realizes that he speaks with the voice of the past as well as with the voice of the future. Somehow that I participate in a reality which has not been yet, which is still unreal. It's very strange. At the same time, I participate in a reality which was and disappeared. That we, past and future are not just tenses, grammatical tenses, but become realities. I represent Abraham as well as the King Messiah, the Melech HaMashiach. I personally, I want to elaborate a little more, I suffer from an excruciating sense of loneliness. I experience time and again my loneliness, my being alone. And this has not come with age. I mean, people with age are old, I mean, have this experience. But this is actually, this experience is a part of me. I mean, the Tei Ve'yis Odom Levadei, those words, is actually are my motto in life. There is a sense of loneliness I have. And I believe if people examine themselves objectively and precisely, they would also discover that they are lonely. People don't think in such terms. And I experience time, time is an experience, I don't mean it as a physical dimension. I experience time as a vehicle coming from nowhere or from eternity and heading toward nowhere. Let's say toward eternity. And I experience myself as a passenger who boards the vehicle for a short time, for a short ride. The vehicle will drop me on its way to eternity. So I am suspended in the air. I mean, don't send me off to Belgium. I am suspended in midair. This is how I experience my own loneliness. And this is completely irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant whether I find myself physically alone in a hotel room or I find myself in company of my family. This metaphysical experience of loneliness is completely independent of surroundings and circumstances. I would say of social loneliness. However, when I begin to think of myself as being a part of a covenantal community, as a member of the covenant, I extend my ontological awareness. I would call it Mino Elam Lado Elam. Let me confide in you. Whenever I am in a bad mood, and it happens quite often, but I'm speaking not about a naturalistic mood, but more in a metaphysical mood, I always take, what do you call it, the medicine that you take me. A tranquilizer don't help. That's the worst of the situation. I have a tranquilizer, I am simply confiding in you. I take a Gemara, the volume of Talmud, and I try to concentrate. But not the intellectual activity which allays the sense of loneliness. Sometimes I fail, but however, sometimes I succeed. And when I do succeed, I suddenly feel as if I had broken out of existential solitude. As if I am not alone anymore. I am in company. I am a part of something bigger than I. I feel as if I were rooted in eternity. And I feel I have friends. I feel as if my manager, I mean, he's a good friend, has been a good friend of mine since my early childhood years. Really, I mean, my manager to me was like a good, wonderful uncle. Not a rich one, but a good uncle. I feel as if my Maimonides or Nachmanides or the Rabbi Netan, I mean, it doesn't matter. But the Chachmei HaMasora, the scholars of the Masora. And so, are present in my study. Sit near me and watch me. And sometimes I feel a caress upon my fatigued face. As if somebody with affection would whisper into my eye, into my ear. And the whisper is, I'm not alone. And this is to me, from as far as mental tranquility is concerned, is from prime importance. I cannot explain it to psychiatrists, nor can I explain it to psychologists. They tell me I'm not. but I want, if what you want, I can tell you I'm normal and I'm sane, completely sane. And I'm very critical about myself and I am not naive. This is an experience of mine. And I'll tell you, it's not only an experience of mine. Because of that experience, we have the chutzpah now, the arrogance, to occupy the entire land of Canaan, which was promised to Abraham, and tell the whole world, we don't care about your opinion. We'll do whatever we deem necessary. Whether you condemn us like the United Nations or not is completely irrelevant. What gives us? I mean, this kind of courage, I would say it's not courage. It's insanity. It's a madness. You know the problem of Eretz Israel? We are confronted by the whole world against us. Even our good friends, even the United States, we are part of the United States. It does not understand our stubbornness and tenacity and complete unreasonableness. Unreasonable. You don't want to negotiate. It's non-negotiable, as the Jews in Eretz Israel tell me, as Begin told me just a few weeks ago. This is the answer. I'm not speaking whether political wise or foolish. This is not the problem. The problem to me is a psychological problem here. Who gave us this kind of arrogance, this kind of chutzpah, to defy the world, to defy not only the world, defy the world, to defy reality, and to defy logic? It's a fact that we came to Israel, we thus dislocated the Arabs. All right, 600,000, a million Arabs doesn't matter. This is completely irrelevant. I mean, the number of Arabs who were dislocated by us. We conquered the land, first we bought land from Effendis, from the lords and Arab lords who spent their time in Paris and sold the land to Jews, and the Jews told the peasants to get off the land. I mean, I'm not an anti-Zionist, I want you to know, but I'm trying to plead for the cause of the Arabs in order to understand ourselves. And we declared an independent state, and then we conquered more land, and we don't want to surrender even one foot of land. Psychologically, where do we, and what resources of fortitude and courage do we draw? What are our sources, psychological sources, out of which the courage and fortitude and readiness to sacrifice, and the issue is ready to sacrifice, and it's very light. What are the sources from which that type of courage, or what shall I say, that type of madness, as Plato used to call divine madness, that type of madness flows? The answer to me, because we are members knowingly or unknowingly, whether we approve of that or you don't approve of that, we are members of the so-called community about which I try to introduce to you. A community, this community is a strange community. It's not temporal, it is rooted in eternity, and many psychological, I would say, experiences change if one feels it is a part of the community. But without introducing the concept of that Masora community, or you want to say, let's take the existential community, the word, I don't like the word, the Masora community, the community where Meilam Vadelam, from the dawn of history, down to, I don't know how to say it, down to Achrit Hayamin, to the end of all time. That, and somehow Eretz Yisrael plays a role in that concept, in that experience. Plays a role because simply because of, in Lech Lecho you read in Chumash in the Pentateuch, where you read that God said, I'll be thy God, and the land will be thine. Always the our relationship to God is somehow identified in some part of the Chumash with our relationship to the land, and I'll conclude a covenant with thee. So we are a covenantal community which embraces not only contemporary people who are alive now, but embraces people who lived, played their historical role, and walked off the stage quietly. They are still right here in our community. It also includes people who haven't appeared yet in the historical arena. Anonymous people. Unknown. Unreal people. But within that type of community, of the covenant community, they are there. And that's why the Jews do crazy things about Hebron. Why do they do such crazy things about Hebron? We have started trouble in Hebron. Not the Arabs. I mean, I know that from reliable sources. Why is Hebron? What's so special about Hebron? Because there is the Moras and Machpelah, the graves of the patriarch. So what's about a grave? The others never got excited about graves. It's not the grave of Abraham. Because Abraham is still alive. He still resides in Hebron. So how can you leave Abraham in the hands of the Arabs under Arab control? So it isn't so crazy what I'm trying to explain to you. It's now, I mean, particularly now. And I'm more excited, not excited, I'm more puzzled by the American Jews. American Jew is a pragmatic Jew. He's a Western Jew, scientifically minded Jew, has a sober approach to life. But American Jew is also committed. And the commitment is in defiance of reality, logic, common sense. That's that kind of community where with the American Jew unknowingly, he doesn't understand it. He's a member, he's a part. And that community somehow has a redemptive, cathartic influence on me whenever I need help.
On the whole world, including the United Nations.
And I'll tell you something else. You mentioned the United Nations. I hope we'll win the battle. It's because, not because we are very powerful and we are indispensable for the foreign policy of the United States. I mean, don't believe all such nonsense. America will get along without us. Without us. George, I want just to say, yes, if the world, the United Nations will give in, and it appears as if the Arabs are, at least, whether it is just politics or they are ready to negotiate with Israel and so forth, is because they don't understand us, but they feel that our argument or our motivation is beyond and above ordinary politics. It is something strange. They feel it, the non-Jew. And if the non-Jew will give in, and finally I hope will give in, will retain Eretz Yisrael, because the non-Jew somehow stands in awe before a people which is defying reality and logic and clinging to a strange kind of community. Yes, no.
Before the Rav goes on to the second question, I think I'll read the rest of the questions. He'll address himself to them. Wait a minute. Anybody has questions that are on their own or that are raised by the first answer that the Rav gave? Yeah. You got the list out?
No, you continue, please, Joe.
The second question that the committee submitted to the Rav was, what are the consequences of the relationship of individual and the group in regard to questions of the Farhesia, Gila Arayos, Kibbutz and...
Just a minute, this question needs elaboration.
Is elaborate.
What does the individual give to the community?
Okay,
just a few lines. I discovered your questions last night. What does the individual Jew contribute to the Knesset Israel? Everything. Creative energy, the religious genius, restlessness and drive. The community is driven by the individual. The individual needs the community. But on the other hand, the community is driven, moved by the individual. Without the charismatic individual, the community would find itself in a state of stagnation. What could the Knesset Israel have been if Moses would not have appeared in the historical arena without Moses? If not Haneke, if not Matisseau Bonhoeff, the individual charts the course, points out the destination, fires the imagination, and supplies the community with the necessary dynamics. However, the community, on the other hand, elevates the individual to great height. It's a very paradoxical relationship, but we are interdependent. The matter of fact, our scholars say, our sages say, that when the golden calf was made and the Jews worshipped him, so God said, Leich Reit, descend. So our scholars say, after all, I mean, you are great because you are representative of the community. And now that the community has betrayed me, I don't need you. With the individual's dependence upon the community. On the other hand, Moshe, if not for Moses, the community wouldn't have achieved what he did achieve, namely the complete covenant with the Almighty. All right, you can go on.
Sorry, maybe we should read all the questions and then go on.
As you
have an idea. What was
Rob said that he had prepared.
Oh, okay,
answer.
Good. All right.
Now, next question. The question is, what are the consequences of the relationship of the individual group in regard to questions of the Farhesia, Gibur Arayis, and Kibbutz Aveim? I'm sorry to say, I understand one. I don't understand the other two. It's a question, it's a triple question. What does it mean?
Well, we try to reformulate a possible reformulation of the question. I don't know.
Question two.
Yes. The way I see formulated is as follows. It would appear that patients and clients present therapists and counselors ethical and moral problems in certain areas, perhaps more than others. Two areas that come to mind are one Arayos and two Cupid Atta Eng. Would it be beneficial for you to present an halakhic overview of these areas to serve as a guide, not as a stock in individual cases, but as a general guide and a means to sensitizing us to an approach and to recognizing shyness to be posed for stock when they arrive?
It's a different question than the one which you
That was the intent of the question.
Okay. If you have particular questions, I'm ready to discuss them, but in general, the question of kibud av va'em in context of a community, the way I described, I portrayed, within the context of an ontological community. In general, what do we understand by kibud av va'em? I can answer this question. If you have specific questions, about social work, about the relationship between the worker and for instance, the son who is rebellious and so forth, is a different problem. But it might cast a light upon your specific problem. You see, if I want simply if I should explain how Kibud Av Va'em comes in within the framework, how can we place? Is it satisfactory to you? Let us leave out Chil, Shabbat, and Farhesi. I don't understand exactly, as a philosophical problem, what you wanted to ask. Let me take up Kibud Av Va'em. Kibud Av Va'em is indeed rooted in the idea of the ontological community, which we have just discussed. There are two dimensions to Kibud Av Va'em, a natural dimension and a metaphysical one. The natural relationship rests upon pragmatic considerations. The community of parent and child is sustained by a quid pro quo awareness. It's a very pragmatic utilitarian community. The child knows that he must have the support of the parent until he reaches maturity, adulthood. Vice versa, father or mother, the parent is also aware of the fact that a time will arrive, a time will come, at which he will be dependent upon the child. Every father knows it, and every child knows it. And it is a purely utilitarian dependence. It is indeed quid pro quo. I read years ago, I don't remember if it was still true or not, but at that time you say it's scientifically correct, the traces of such a practical relationship between young and old, between small and big, are detectable in the zoological kingdom, in the animal kingdom. Even though it is, as far as animal is concerned, an exclusively instinctual mechanical drive, it's a push, nothing else. While among human beings, the instinctual drive turns into an emotion, and sometimes into a noble emotion, constructive noble emotion, such as love or respect, love for the parent, and so forth. This is a one community, parent and child. This is a natural community. I would call it a sociological community. Applying Rousseau's theory, contract social, there is a silent contract social between the father and child. As long as I'm little, you support me, then I'll get the father that as long as I'm little, you support me, and the father tells the child, then I'll get old and be unable to earn a livelihood or to do the necessary things into which one has to engage, so you'll help me. You'll tell me there's no such contract social, there is no such contract social between the individual and the community, either. But this is the interpretation, rather. This is number one. However, yeah, However, the relationship between parent and child was elevated by Judaism to an ontological level, to a higher level, much higher. The community of parent and child is an ontological one, or call it existential community. When a parent say, the famous word by Descartes, sum, I am. What is understood by I am? The I embraces plain psychologicalism, as a matter of fact. The child as well. When father says I, and is a loving father of a child, it means I and my son exist. He doesn't isolate himself from his son, from his baby. It's together. As a matter of fact, it is basically a triple awareness. But when there is father and mother, a young father and a young mother and a young child, a baby, when the mother and father say, I am, sum, it embraces three people. Mother, father, and the child. And vice versa. When a child says, I am, a child, a young child, the child cannot imagine his being as separate from the being of his mother, particularly father. It is a triple awareness. And when father, for instance, I can again draw my own experience. It's hard for me to draw an experience of other people. My father has been dead for 35 years. My mother has been dead for 10 years, in the process. And still, I feel a certain emptiness in life when I think of them. Somehow my very being has been affected by their death. And as if the bottom had been knocked out. It's very strange. As long as father and mother were alive, I was not confronted by the angel of death. In some way, he was behind my father and mother. He was behind them. The very moment they died, so the next morning I woke up to find the Malach HaMoves confronting me. But it means that my sum awareness, the Cartesian sum, the I am awareness, includes father and mother as well. And once they are not, and they are gone, so is my awareness not complete. I am affected, metaphysically, I mean, ontologically. Because because Yahadus spoke of father not only as a provider. He performed not only the role that Joseph performed in Egypt, he provided them with food. Yahadus wanted the son to think of father and mother not only as providers, but as the source, as the origin. What do you call in Hebrew makor, or what the Greeks used to call archei? As the origin, as the foundation of my being. If not for father and mother, I wouldn't have been in existence. It's not only a biological fact, not only a biological fact, it's more than a biological fact. It is an ontological reality, it's an existential fact. Father is my, is like, I'm rooted in being through my roots in father. I extend the root in being, but through my father. I wouldn't have been real if not for him. It's not a biological, again, not a biological fact. It is an existential reality. So in such a case, so I have a double awareness. The practical awareness, my religion, a double community. The practical community between child and father, and mother and so forth, and then the ontological community. When I say I am, it means I am together with father. And interesting is that the halacha has developed two mitzvahs pertaining to the relationship between kibud avraham. One mitzvah is called kibud, kabeit. You know how the halacha interprets kabeit in terms of giving service, physical service. If father is old, you should help him into dress and you should feed him. Simple physical service. You should do for father everything which is required. My father as a natural being, that's all. And that's all, I mean, as a matter of fact, I must tell you, mother man, if he has learned something from the Bible, is perhaps kibbut he did learn. People, you know, of course I know cases which people acted like savages vis-a-vis their own parents, but on the whole, person supports his parents if they cannot earn a living, and he'll give them service, physical service. But Yahadus was not satisfied with this kind of service. Yahadus says, Ish inei v'oviv tiro. Each one of you must fear father and mother. What do you mean fear? I mean, father doesn't mean fear in the sense of being frightened or being terrorized. What it means, fear means to respect, to revere, to stand in awe before father and mother. And the law has quite a bundle of dinim. I should not call the father by his first name. I should not contradict his opinions, even though I may think he's wrong, but I should not say, Pa, Dad, you are wrong, something which you do every day. It is so. You should not sit in his place, should not occupy the chair which is assigned to him, and so forth on. It's a relationship of awe, not of gratitude. Gratitude warrants physical support. But gratitude does not warrant a relationship of awe on the part of the son vis-à-vis his father. So what warrants the relationship of awe is the fact that father to me was not only a provider, but more than a provider. Because he was the beginning of it. Of course, I mean, many rebellions, or what do you call it, the late turmoil, the late adolescent turmoil, are not in accord with this relationship to father, mother. I mean, the existential relationship. I form with them in one community. to me, to my opinion, I mean, I'm not a social worker, but I have been a rabbi for many years. In Vilanila, I had to deal with cases which belong to social workers. But I tried, in many cases I send the patient who needs help straight to a social agency. But in some cases, I try to treat them. I don't know, I try to apply those metaphysical conclusions to actual work, to actual rabbinic work, I wouldn't say social work. I failed in many cases, but in a few cases I had great success. All right. What else?
Joe, I wonder if we could... I was given some information that one of our visitors has a question that might be...
Oh, go ahead.
It sounded like it's within the context of our discussion, and I'd like to use it.
Oh, go ahead.
Tony Warwick from JASA came prepared with a concern that he has, and I think it fits, but he'll have to make the connection, please.
What does the Torah true individual owe the community?
You mean the community, the Knesset Israel?
Yes.
Everything?
Yes.
Everything?
Everything.
Everything. This is the concept of Mesiras Nefesh. This is the concept of... Of course, it is, first of all, it's a question of gratitude, the spiritual thing, as you say. And it's also to be observed in daily life. The question of Doke and Chesed and all the laws are rooted in this strange relationship between individual and community. And on the other hand, the community owes everything to the individual. As a matter of fact, until this day, sometimes practical questions come up. I don't know whether Yahadus is of the opinion that the death of one is less important,
less tragic,
than the death of a million. While secular culture, civilization works with this premise, I mean, as something which has categorical significance. I'm not too sure that Yahadus is. Sometimes you have the impression that the individual has to sacrifice himself in order to save the community. And sometimes you come across halachas which contradict this approach. And say, yes, the community, of course, but who is going to say that the life, one life is not as important as the life of a million? And the approach is a dialectical one on the part of Yahweh. Yes, sir?
I would like to attempt to try to translate some of the philosophical equation into some of the psychological equations,
yes.
And see, you know, with the perils in that, and to try to see if we can come to the formulation. We talked about lonely men, we talked about social man, and I seem to be hearing that there's, well actually let me ask it in the form of a question, is there an inherent value that one takes precedence over the other, that one is more important than the other? Is it possible to see one as being in contradiction to the other?
What do you understand by one? What would you say by
one? The needs of the lonely man versus the needs of the social community, the social man. Is it possible to see a contradiction occurring between the two? And if one, if that would happen, is it that one would always take precedence?
I mean, I believe in the paper I dealt with this problem. It is not, this is the relationship is a dialectical one. In this sense, we are engaged, I mean, willy-nilly, we are engaged in a movement of withdrawal from the community into the, so to say, into a existential solitude. Yeah, and at the same time, there is this movement of surging forward from this solitude toward the community. There are many, many laws which can be explained in terms of a movement of withdrawal, of a movement of recoil, and some laws, on the contrary, demand from man they should come closer to the community. It's basically, it is like a pendulum swinging between two poles. I come to the community, I stay there for a while, and as the Pentateuch tells of Moses, Moshe yikach Israel v'notale mechutz l'machne. And Moses took the tent and he pitched the tent outside of the machne, outside of the camp. He withdrew. And at the same time, we read in Chumash that God told Moses he should make two trumpets in order to assemble the people, and he should be in the middle.
If one brings this down to a situation that a social worker might find in his practice, if we have a family situation, I'm doing hypothetical in this particular case, where the husband, let's say, is neglecting the family for communal pursuits, his social man aspect vis-a-vis problems that are coming up in the home.
I know the case. I'll tell you frankly, if such a case would have come before me, I would always justify the approach of the woman. Of the woman. It means you should not neglect this family life because on account of the community. But I don't believe that it's directly that this problem is involved in my presentation. I don't believe. In general, Yahadus, in showing bias, what you call, is a very important principle in Yahadus. And a matter of fact, I want to add something to your question. Yes. The marital community is also part of the great community. The community begins with Adam and Eve, and it expands and includes more individuals. But Sholem Bayis means the Sholem or the harmony within an existential community. Within an existential community. Of course, it's a small community, but the fact that it's small does not mean that it's an unimportant or without significance.
I wonder, is there someone in the group that would have a question before we go back to the Rav for a few moments? Please, your name?
My name is Charles Brunson. I'd like to ask the Rav, in the parent-child relationship, the Rav has said that the aspect of kavod, of physical service, is on certain levels a quid pro quo for the parent being a provider. And that the aspect of gerah has to do with the parent being the root, the makar, the link of the past.
Correct.
What is the parallel to gerah as far as it being a quid pro quo? Do the parents have to view the child as a link to the future? And what sort of practical implications does that have?
I don't understand exactly the question.
As far as kavod, the parent provides for the child when the child is young, and therefore the child provides for the parent.
Yeah.
As far as the child viewing the parent as their link to the past, and that having certain obligations,
yes,
attending to it, does the parent have to view, and does it have any obligations or implications, the parent viewing the child as their link to the future?
Sabre, the whole obligation of education, of teaching Torah to the children. As a matter of fact, I mean, because of that, the parent, that a parent is the beginning of the child, but the child is the continuation of the existential, of the reality, of the existential reality of the parent. He's the link to the he. He's, so to say, the bridge which leads the parent into the distant future. I don't know. If you have other questions, I can answer other questions. What is the next question?
The third question was, I don't know whether you want to talk about, are there people?
Yeah, this question I didn't answer because I didn't understand.
Dr. Khan,
the question is
responsible for it.
The question is,
I deny
it. Are there people, Jews or non-Jews, that a religious therapist should not take on as a client? I didn't understand the question.
Perhaps I could amplify. It's not by question. I try to amplify it. There are a few situations in which the answer would appear to be obvious. There are other situations where it does not seem to be so clear. Let me give you some practical situations. For instance, for those who are involved in what's now called death counseling, if you have an individual who comes and says, I'm having difficulty, I'm not married, but I want to alleviate any difficulty that I have in terms of this girl that I'm living with, that would seem to be a situation where the counselor must say, I refuse to accept you as a client. I cannot handle the situation because of my own commitment. Another situation might be where, let's say, a homosexual would come and say, I demand that you help me alleviate whatever guilt I feel with regard to the homosexual relationship. That if that is the contract that is formulated, cannot be reformulated in other terms, then the therapist would have to say, I'm sorry, but I cannot go along with that contract.
It makes sense. Huh?
It makes sense.
Yeah.
There is a situation that once happened with me, and with using hindsight, I'm rather unhappy that I didn't ask for guidance at that time, but again, I'll use it as a specific case. A Rosh Yeshiva once sent me a couple for marriage counseling because the couple was breaking up. They were no longer living together, and the goal, as it was formulated, was to see if I could help save the marriage. Very quickly, became evident that both the husband and wife were involved in extramarital affairs. Now, there were other problems involved as well, but to go along, would it have been possible for a therapist to go along with the possible goal of saving a marriage which was obviously against halakha? In other words, the marriage cannot be saved and yet abide by halakhic dictums in such a case. So how does one work with that kind of situation as it is presented?
This is the problem.
Yes.
And this is only in your contractual obligation is to save the marriage.
That's the way it was
formed. Or to alleviate the feeling of guilt in homosexuality. That's what he said, yeah. Yeah. But he was not ready to abandon the practice. I'm not a social worker, it's hard for me to say. You have no right to try to that he should change his way and his ways, and you have to right away at the very beginning justify what his practices and help him just to be a sinner and a happy person. If this is your job, you should not accept. If this is your job, to protect him. One should sin and not feel guilty about it. One should commit a crime and not feel sorry for it. If this is your job, of course it is. But I believe there is always freedom. You have enjoyed the freedom. Somehow to change him. Willingly or unwillingly to try to change him. If you realize it, it's impossible. But I would believe that you shouldn't abandon, you should not reject any case. Because every case there is, we believe that a human being has a potential, and a potential of tshuva, of coming back, of returning. And the social worker should, I believe, works with this idea, the idea of having faith in a person. Of course, he should not lend himself to be a, so to say, to be the one to encourage the person to commit a sin. But there's always a chance, there's always a hope. As long as the hope prevails, that you may change him completely, I would say you should deal with him. But I cannot tell you when and how. I mean, it depends upon this each individual situation. Yes?
Gary?
Yeah, in relation to that, if the goal is to bring the person around to
the right way,
to the right way, but the process might be deviant from the halakhic point of view, how far can you use yourself in that process?
What do you mean? You mean
an example? I'll give you an example. When we talk about keep it up, that aim, the eventual aim, let us say, is a good relationship between father and son, between parent and child. But in the process to bring this about, one has to have the child confront parents. What we might call a disrespect to parents.
I understand.
How far can we use our?
Your question is related to keep it up, aim. This question is related to sex offenders.
All right.
There is a difference as far as the answer is concerned. In Kibbutz Av Ha'im, you may try, you may experiment, you may take a risk. Not in such a case. In sex offenses, if you are convinced more or less that it's difficult, perhaps. In Kibbutz Av Ha'im, I would recommend patience, and the child should confront the parent once and twice. Even though he'll manifest disrespect for the parents, if the objective which you want to achieve is a good one, so it is quite not unpermissible, it's recommendable. But not with regard to, because there's a difference. I don't believe it's necessary to explain. But to encourage somebody to continue his homosexualist practices because I have hope that finally he'll change, I wouldn't take the risk. The kind of offense is a different one, and with our sensitivity, I mean, to sex laws, and Yahadus was, I mean, there are many mitzvahs in Yahadus, many mitzvahs, many laws, but some laws were emphasized, re-emphasized the most important ones. And namely, the laws pertaining to sex morality. So I would not try to play with them. I would be more careful, unless it is quite probable that I may change the present. But if this probability does not exist, it's just a possibility. As far as Kibbutz Av Ha'im is concerned, I would say it exhausts all the possibilities, but not as far as sex morality is concerned. Yes, no?
No sound,
I'm sure.
David?
Yeah.
Make loud enough so they can hear you in the back, please.
Just in the area that Dr. Kahn mentioned earlier about sexual situations, there's sometimes a problem that comes up in my practice where, especially with women who are in college, who are not coming because of any particular problem with regard to their sexual context, but that it comes up in the context of whatever else they're coming with. And the problem that's involved very often is that they are involved, they are not married, they're involved with someone else who is not married. And for example, they're not using any sort of birth control device, and they're coming to me and asking me advice about that. And my options are really very limited. On the one hand, it's not the problem that they're coming into treatment for. On the other hand, I certainly don't want to give any kind of information about that which certainly I have no halakhic expertise in whatsoever. And the third possibility is if I don't give it, I may be faced with a patient who's now going to come and ask me about abortion. I mean, that's the chance that I would take by not answering that question, by not in any way dealing with that issue. And that's happened a number of times, and I don't think I've ever dealt with it particularly successfully.
This question, I mean, what they are addressed to you, should we address to a doctor rather?
It could be, except that I, at this point, am the person this patient trusts. I mean, I certainly could go to a doctor to get the specific information, but I mean, I'm assuming there's not a medical reason at this point for birth control. It's only because of convenience, not because there's any medical problem.
So what is the element of risk here, if you should refuse to advise them, so what?
Well, the possibility that...
Next time we'll have an abortion problem.
Yes.
I don't believe you are responsible for events in the future. I don't believe that you have to look out for it and that you are supposed to encourage her to come back if the whenever the problem of abortion will arise.
There are a couple of people here who are very seem to be very perplexed and uncomfortable with that question. Do you want to respond to the question, not to what the Rav said at the moment? This gentleman in the back here with the with the wine-colored sweater. You look as if you wanted to respond. No? Okay, I just wanted to make sure that... Molly, would you like to... Mrs.
Yes.
Kovach?
We very often have questions in a family counseling agency, such as the one in which I work, where questions of abortion are now becoming more prevalent. And very often this involves a Jewish couple or a Jewish single person. And how do we deal with this from a halachic as a traditional worker? I might also add...
Just a moment, excuse me, will you be so kind of repeat? What is the question?
How do we deal with the problem of abortion?
Abortion, I can tell you how you should deal, but I can tell you the law. It's not a... Called Jewish law, it's not a... No. It's not a matter. The embryo, the fetus, has a right to life. I mean, and killing a fetus comes under leis yotzach. Thou shalt not kill. Not. What you should do, I don't know. The Jewish law is opposed to unless there is a problem of survival, as far as the mother is concerned. Then you are very liberal. But abortion for convenience, or abortion because I cannot be bothered by a child, or I have already a few children, those abortions come under the category rubric of research, of murder. Of course, the law is that if you kill an embryo, there is no death penalty. Yeah, but this does not minimize, I mean, the quality or the severity of the transgression. It's a very severe violation.
Is there a distinction of time or not?
If there's a distinction of time, it's a very short one, it's 40 days.
Marcia, then...
In relation to all the questions that were mentioned, I can see that when both the worker and the client are halakhically knowledgeable or at least have an involvement or a commitment to halakha, that all these questions are applicable or realistically applicable or comprehensible. But what happens when, and I think this is most of the cases, when the worker is involved with halakha, is committed to halakha, but the client is in the state of Kino Shanishba, and is there a different consideration that becomes involved there?
I don't see how you can have a different relationship to the client. Your relationship to the client should not depend upon the client's commitment to the Jewish law or his secular convictions. However, you see, sometimes when a secular client, a non-believer comes for advice, and the social worker is committed to halacha, I mean, cooperates with him without engaging right away in reprimands or rebukes or in preaching and sermonizing, I mean, gets along nicely with the client, and he achieves wonderful results, I know that. That I cannot advise, I cannot say, it's up to the social worker, it depends upon the situation, it's very hard. This is the method, this used to be the method, of Chabad. Chabad had an understanding for people who deviated from the right path, and it extends a helping hand in many cases, helping hand to them. Yeah. But they were successful in many cases because they displayed temporarily tolerance. If the client comes in to the social worker or to the rabbi, and right away he feels that the rabbi condemns him, and the rabbi condemns him, and the rabbi reached a verdict that he's guilty, and when the rabbi's face is full of rebuke and reproach, so you can rest assured neither the social worker nor the rabbi will bring him back to Judaism. He has to work it with a sense, perhaps, from the sense of tolerance for a while, in order to gain his confidence and his respect for you. Then you can accomplish things which are unbelievable. I'll give you an example. A certain girl from a prominent American Jewish family, in New York, somehow was beaten by the bag and became a Balchure. But she was not ready to accept Tayag Mitzvah. Tayag Mitzvah, for the non-observing Jew, is a terrible burden, at least from afar. Terrible burden. People ask me, how can you walk on Shabbos without carrying a handkerchief along? It is a burden. You have to be trained and disciplined in order to take it not as a burden but as a privilege. But to the stranger, to the outsider, to the ger, it's a terrible burden. Shabbos is the 39 kind of work, dietary laws, and particularly pertaining sex morality, which is very strict in Yahadus, is viewed by outsiders as burdensome. So the girl wanted actually, she was sincere, and very sincere. And she wanted actually to be a good Jewess, but she was not ready to accept the 630 mitzvahs. So she went to some gadol here, Reish Yeshiva. He said to her, either you accept the 613, it was Friday, and tonight you begin to observe Shabbos, or drop, forget about it. She felt disappointed, she went to somebody else. I'm not at liberty to mention names. Somebody else. Also, Yerei Shamayim, and perhaps a canoe in that place that the Rosh Hashiva was. So he said to her, all right, if you can't accept all 613, accept one mitzvah. But a difficult one. But that mitzvah you should carry out, implement precisely in accordance with the letter of the law. That she took, she accepted. She accepted kashrus. And she began to observe kashrus, and actually she observed it conscientiously. Now she lives in Eretz Yisrael. America is polluted as far as she is concerned. And she marries mitzvahs kedinah mitzvahs. This is the example which I can give you. It doesn't mean that the second one was less tolerant, was less of a Yerei Shamayim than the first one, but he knew how to befriend the stranger. When the prophet says, Shuvu Bonim Shevovim Shuvu Yisrael, so it means frivolous children come back, so it means at first we have the impression that he accepts the frivolity on their part. But basically it's a diplomatic approach. We accepted their frivolity, but by accepting their frivolity, and lack of discipline, he befriended them, and then the influence he gained over them accomplished miracles.
I have one more question from Tommy Schwartz, and then I want to sum up. Excuse me, Mr. Schwartz.
I want to refer back to the Rav's earlier remark on the dialectic between lonely man and communal man, social man. And in a very personal way, you sort of indicated how one extricates himself from loneliness through a formulation of communion with Knesset Yisrael.
Yeah.
Is that the only method? First, is that the halakhic method? Or is it a personal method?
It's a personal method.
Secondly, is this a necessary kind of extrication? The
does one have to extricate himself from loneliness via Knesset Yisrael, or perhaps find greater loneliness in himself? And is this wrong? Or is this not in keeping
I don't get it. You know, this is the only method how to free myself from loneliness. Well, there's another approach, another method, namely...
I ask.
I'll tell you frankly, my method, I extricate myself from this destructive experience of loneliness. Basically, it's not destructive, it's a very creative experience. It's a creative experience. Because community man, community-related man is not creative, it's not creative. Lonely man is creative. It's simply by engaging in creative activities.
But isn't this a form of dilution?
What?
The extrication process into Knesset Yisrael with the communion through Knesset Yisrael.
I joined the Knesset Yisrael.
Isn't it a dilution of creativity? Is there not a form of extrication?
I mean, we swing back and forth between loneliness and Knesset Yisrael. In certain situations, I mean, we try to withdraw completely into ourselves. It's more than introspection or introversion, it's more than that. It's awareness. In other situations, we search forward toward the Knesset, toward being together with the Knesset Israel. But creativity, I mean, when you feel that your resources have been exhausted, and you have to replenish them, you withdraw, you go back into your solitude. When you feel you have a lot, you want to give them. At certain times, I don't want to give, I don't want to teach. I've been a teacher for many years. People say that I'm a good teacher. You know why, if I'm a good, if I am, if they are right, I doubt. But if I'm a good teacher, you know why? Because in my class, I always form a community. And I would say an existential community. First of all, a community which embraces me and the children. I have 100 children in my class. I want to say, you know. 100 children there. I'm not technical. I don't say a shiur. We discuss problems, we debate problems. And even many times happens that I'm on the wrong side and they are on the right side. They are right, I'm wrong. I always admit it. Because if you want to create a community, you have to be sincere and consistent. And other times I say, what I cannot say the shiur to me. I have nothing to say to them. They know as much as I do as far as the shiur is concerned. Let me retreat from them, I mean. And basically, these moments when you feel empty, and the pressure of the creative persona in you is tremendous, then you retreat. When you replenish your resources, you feel a desire of giving. The Ram calls chesed, this is chesed according to my manas, of giving. You have so much that you cannot accommodate all that. So you want others to share. This is very volatile sometimes, and sometimes it may last for weeks. Speaking about my own experiences, and I believe that everybody had the same experience.
Are you more into personal on Shabbos or during the week?
Excuse me, Joe. Robert Alvarez, if you want to close with your brief question, please.
Is there a difference between someone who comes into a rabbi and asks a question, because the rabbi then becomes the rabbi because the rabbi represents halacha, otherwise he wouldn't come to him. However, the average client comes into an agency, and it so happens that in the agency there may be someone who is orthodox or traditional, but he doesn't come to him because of the fact that he is representing halacha. And then I think in that context there may be a difference of approach.
I'll tell you, I mean, essentially there is no difference in a rabbi and a social worker. All Jews are all committed. I mean, the fact that I am a rabbi and someone else a social worker does not relieve me of certain duties. On the contrary, it doesn't add anything, I mean, to my duties as a Jew. I mean, it's a question of tactics, correct? Of method, yes. I mean, in my opinion, a social worker can accomplish more than the rabbi. Then the rabbi, you know, the Jew says, it's his business, all right. His business, get paid for it, so that's why his concern. Yeah,
both and the have expertise, power.
But the one who comes for the rabbi, the two types are come to the rabbi. If I may draw up my own experience, one is he doesn't like the rabbi, so he's not ready to change. He comes to the rabbi in order to tease.
Yeah.
Let me see what that guy will have to say. And that's all. It's just for fun to the rabbi. Yeah. The second, another person comes when he's ready to make the leap, so to say, the impossible, of course, in the children. But he wants to become some other encouragement of somebody. He wouldn't go to a social worker because he's not sure social worker will agree with him. He goes to the rabbi because he knows very well the rabbi will give him his consent and will agree with him. Yeah, usually. The social worker comes people, so to say, beshegig, bemazig, knowingly, unknowingly, I mean, for help. That sometimes the rabbi has an easy job, but I believe the social worker on the whole can accomplish more than the rabbi. Because the fact that he's neutral, at least people think that he's neutral and he's objective, but the rabbi, in their opinion, is subjective. And already he's not only subjective, somehow he's concerned, he has concern for the Jewish law. It makes the rabbi actually sometimes ineffectual, ineffective as far as counseling of clients are concerned.
On behalf of all of you, I'd like to just make clear a point that this room is full of people who are not social workers as well. There are psychologists here, psychotherapists, and psychiatrists, who I know, and then some plain people. But I think the Rav's remarks throughout always indicate that any person can be helpful to other people. I will not try to do any resume that I define anyone being capable of pulling something like this together. I would like to say one thing, though, that Rabbi Soloveitchik does some fancy footwork in the sense, if I may. He wants to deal with an idea or ideas, and we're always trying to drag him down to earth. And I wonder if sometime we might plan in the future a place where we could ascend with him to the idea that he wants to elaborate and clarify, and stay up there in suspension with him as he described it, and then later perhaps, when we come down, we might have a better idea of what our feet are and what the earth is that we're touching. So on behalf of all of you, I'd like to extend a very deep thank you very much, Rabbi Soloveitchik, for giving us your time and energy.
We want to express our love, our affection, and our esteem to our Rebbe and our halakhic consultant. And therefore, we have laminated one of our membership certificates, which certifies our sentiments in writing, so he can take it and always have it on his mizrach to know that we are as extensive community at all times.
You don't have to pay dues? Don't have to pay dues?
So, the only important thing is that you may read that, that these children may need that, or these children.